Hello? I know you're there. Look, I can see the lights of the TV. Please, I just want to watch the finale. Come on, guys. I'll give you a foot massage or anything.
Time to get your own fiber? Speak to Vox. Because for a limited time period, you can save up to 3,000 Rand in installation costs. And we'll send a technician to help you get set up.
Hello?
Go to vox.co.za. Get fiber to your home. Get free installation and activation. Open the door to endless entertainment.
T's and C's apply.
Bitco is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. Bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
I'm Duncan McLeod, and you're listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm on an internet call now with Kit van Sail, investment partner at Cape Town-based venture capital firm Knife Capital. Kit, welcome to the show, and thanks for talking to Tech Central today.
Thanks, Duncan. It's a pleasure.
So the reason we're chatting today is Knife Capital has just concluded a major exit of one of its investments to Uber Eats. Before we talk about that, though, Akiat, tell me a bit about yourself and your background and how Knife Capital got its start.
Good. Well, I think I'm an emancipated accountant and an ex-banker. Ended up in venture capital with Mark Shuttleworth's fund, Yerby Dragons VC, HBD. And that's also where the co-founder of Knife Capital, myself, Eben van Heerden, met. You know, we're working there, basically investing the fund two, 150 million VC fund, investing in sort of post-revenue growth equity type businesses. And so in June 2010, we spun out Knife Capital from HBD, basically co-founded Knife Capital and approached Mark for the management contract. So swapped our salary slips for a management fee, essentially, and continued the active management of the HBD VC assets in South Africa. And over time, have gained new funders, new funding partnerships, both here and in London, and exited a lot of the HBD investment, which we'll talk about just now. So that's sort of how it started. Andrea Bowman, one of our other investment partners, joined shortly after we founded Knife. Bob Skinstad, which I know from a long time from university days, joined and set up, started working for a family office in London called Draper Gain Investments. And through that, also, we are now backed by Draper Gain and have a London presence.
Is Mark still involved in venture capital at all?
He is involved in ventures. He's still very much involved in open source software,
yeah,
but not so much actively involved in venture capital investments in South Africa anymore.
All right. So, Kit, tell me a bit about the funds that you've launched to date, the size of them, and who the investors have been in those funds, if you can disclose that level of information.
Yeah, maybe not to the nth degree, but I mean, you know, we're quite proud of what we've done. We, you know, a lot of, and we'll talk maybe a little bit later about the venture capital space in South Africa and so forth. But, you know, it is difficult to raise funding for high-risk ventures, you know, all over the world, but specifically in South Africa where there is a culture of risk aversion. SARS came to the party in some way, shape, or form with launching a SARS Section 12J venture capital companies, which basically just mean that investors in approved VCCs can deduct that investment from taxable income. And that obviously creates a nice risk sort of appetite profile or a tax benefit, which pushes some investors over the edge, which are interested in the space. So we've got a VCC company called K&F Ventures, stands for Knowledge, Networks, and Funding, which we believe are the three elements to combine for any high growth venture to succeed. So we've got about 60 investors in there, a minimum R1 million investment, and a couple, so do the math. So that's where we are on that one. And then we also have a few angels that we co-invest with, and our main source of funding for deals predominantly when we do ones outside of South Africa comes from Draper Gain Family Office in London.
All right. So, Kate, you're announcing today that Uber Eats, which is the food delivery service owned by Uber, has acquired one of your investments, restaurant technology company Order Talk. How significant is this deal, and how did it come about?
Yeah, for us, this is a very, very significant transaction for many reasons. One, because, you know, it's been a long and windy road, successful in the end with Auditalk, great entrepreneurs. I mean, we invested in this business a number of years ago via the HBD fund in 2008 already. Over time, we found that it's basically a restaurant online ordering technology, which sounds, you know, on the outset, you know, what's in that. But at the time, 10 years ago, when Uber Eats and all these things didn't exist, a lot of restaurants had to sort of, I guess, were getting disrupted by delivery services and so forth, and had to get onto the bandwagon, which isn't their core business, you know. So what Auditalk did is basically take that off their hands, integrated with their point of sale system, and made that a seamless integration workflow, basically prints out in the kitchen and they get on with it. And we found that the addressable market in South Africa wasn't as big as other markets internationally, and our main client base started coming out of the UK and the US, and we moved the company over time, or at least the operations and the technology side of it, over to Dallas, to the US. Via that became a really high growth company, and over time, yeah, and I guess when we now sort of looked at exiting, it was a bittersweet one for us, because the company is quite sustainable and revenue generating and cash flow generating. It pays dividends, and that the one nice thing about this investment, it's already paid its whole investment back via dividends before this exit.
Wow.
And on the other hand, you know, it's good to see the founders getting something out of it after these years. It's good to close the investment. Uber Eats is a great investment partner to have. You know, they basically acquire this company to streamline their workflows by directly integrating in these leading point of sale services systems. So it really helps them go faster than they are in terms of this land grab space of online ordering. And I mean, I think for us, the very significant thing is that it does close that 150 million HBD fund. It's the last exit. We've had a number of other exciting exits. First one being a company, a predictive analytics company called C-Sense to General Electric. The second one was a specialist mobile financial services company, Fundamo, to Visa.
That was a big exit, right?
That was, yeah. It was $110 million.
Wow.
In total. And we had a significant chunk of that. But also, I mean, good co-investors in Remgro and Sanlam. And Hannes van Rensburg wrote a book about that exit, Cash In, Cash Out. It was really, I mean, all of these things really have fond battle scars in this journey of VC. But you know, if I take my Knife Capital HBD hat off, the reason why we are celebrating this and exit and fund closure significantly, because, you know, people, naysayers, look at venture capital and say, well, it's very high risk, can it succeed and that? And, you know, we really proved to ourselves more than anyone else that it can work. You know, you can get a fund, pay it back to the investor many times over, launch successful companies, make interesting friendships along the way, and build your network, launch additional funds, and the whole system kind of carries on. So I think that's very significant from where SME space is and where South Africa is at the moment in disruptive technologies and where we want to position ourselves.
So what was your stake in Auditalk, and has Uber bought out 100% of the business now?
Yeah, we had a significant minority stake in the business, so not more than 50%, but we kind of always want to make sure that the entrepreneurs get out of bed in the morning for themselves and don't come work for a bunch of investors, and that's sort of our model. But yeah, Uber bought the 100% of the business. It is always more easier, I mean, so it's never easy, but it's always more desirable if the shareholders are aligned for a 100% exit. You know, you don't want a 5% or a 10% shareholder saying, actually, hang on, I want to still come along for the ride, because that might, or usually then not fall into the strategy of the strategic acquirer. So yeah, so it's a full-on exit, but the management team continue on. The tech team continues on, so it's not as if that team will be integrated into Uber strategies from there onwards. And there's obviously a period where the core team would have to stay involved. And yeah, from there onwards, we will probably do some other interesting things with them if they're keen.
Yeah. So the business was originally founded in Cape Town, was it?
It's founded in, it has always these things that have interesting tales. It was founded on the back of in 1998 already, on the back of a US-based client, Jason's Deli, that wanted a ordering solution. So Hilton Keats, the founder, sort of more consulted and developed a system for them. Patrick Eldon, the CEO, came on board in 2004 and basically brought the business and founded it in Cape Town and made it more formal. You know, AuditTalk was established as a South African Cape Town company, but then, as I mentioned, over time, we then established AuditTalk Inc. In Delaware, and that's the obviously the company that Uber acquired, but it's still owned by that company. Is obviously owned by the shareholders and our shareholding by AuditTalk in South Africa.
All right. Now, you mentioned already that you've had some significant exits to major international tech companies. You mentioned Visa, GE, and now Uber. But there was also a business that was bought by Garmin. I think they did radar for bicycle riders, didn't they?
Yeah, so that one was a very interesting company. It's a company called Ikubu.
That's right, yes.
We've got an accelerator program in Knife Capital called Grindstone. So, you know, we do take stakes in companies, try and take very much earlier stage companies, partner with them, and basically engineer their growth path. So Ikubu was partnered with us in Grindstone program. We got them funding ready. We were involved there, and they were acquired by Garmin. And basically, they developed a bicycle radar device, which you can look put behind your saddle, 150 meters back through rain, fog, and all the rest of it. You can see if cars are approaching via a little unit on your handlebars. And for Garmin, that was a very enticing proposition. They acquired Ikubu for two reasons. One, to launch this Garmin product. They call it the Garmin Varia. It is really one of the top tech gadgets of 2015 in worldwide. So they obviously have the gusto and the marketing spend and the channels behind them to be able to make some of these devices a much bigger success than a small company out of Stellenbosch can do. But the second reason is also to develop and to establish a Garmin Research and Development Center in Stellenbosch. So the core team still involved there from Ikubu, that basically now runs the Garmin R&D center in Stellenbosch, and that obviously is for disruptive technologies coming out of Africa and that, you know. So I think that's the other thing that exits like these prove to us, is that, you know, our technologists and our technology, you know, young people with their, you know, patents and IP and coding and so forth are world class, you know. So if companies like Garmin comes and establish their R&D centers, companies like Uber, Visa, all these acquire our technologies. This is how these top companies grow, by basically, you know, developing in-house and then also acquiring the best of the best. And that's also something South Africa can be proud of.
Yeah, some big exits here. It sounds like Knife Capital has been perhaps more successful than some of the other VC funds out there in South Africa. What is the state of the VC industry in South Africa? I've often heard people say that it's quite immature relative to other markets, especially, of course, the US. Is that a statement you'd agree with necessarily?
Definitely a statement I would agree with in terms of the maturity. I think just the comment on Knife Capital. Yeah, I mean, luck and timing. So I would acknowledge the role of luck that we've had. I mean, we believe we have some designs and partnerships in the way we invest, but then you need a little bit of something, chips to fall your way, firstly. Secondly, time in the saddle. You know, this does take long. And I think a lot of the other VCs or some of the VCs just haven't had significant exits yet because of the fact that, you know, they're fairly newly established and, you know, some of the other things are a little bit under the radar. It's not everyone publicizes everything that happens. So we are aware of many success stories. Certainly Knife is not the only crowd in town, and there's some really credible VCs that we co-invest with and that co-invest together and are credible funding partners. In terms of where we are as an ecosystem or a state of VC in South Africa, you know, we really find it's a very exciting space in South Africa at the moment. It is still early stage, as you mentioned. So, yeah, there are interesting developments in South African VC space, like the Star Section 12J VCC funds. There's more than 100 of them at the moment, and that's gaining traction to develop and invest early stage SMEs. there's many type of business incubators, accelerators, mentorship programs that assist. There are crowdfunding is kind of getting off the ground. Institutions like SAFCA, the South African Venture Capital and Private Equity Association, and SIMADISA are really focusing to ensure that VC becomes a recognized asset class. And, you know, government is also coming to the table in a way. So this whole concept around mentorship capital, you know, giving people an incentive to make these businesses succeed. There's an SME fund from the CEO initiative, which will provide additional funding to some of the VCs. Yeah, so there are quite a lot of exciting things happening, not to mention, I mean, the only reason why the industry is really exciting and getting off the ground is because of our amazing entrepreneurs that we can invest in and partner with. They are getting a little bit more mature in terms of, you know, valuation expectations and so forth. But it's still a difficult space to raise money out there for risky ventures. You know, a good idea is not necessarily a good company, and a good company is not necessarily a good investment. You know, you really need to know what to look for in the due diligence, how to price accordingly. I mean, you're only really going to find out 5, 6, 7, 10 years later whether you are going to exit this thing successfully and generate a return. And there's many permutations in that path that can go right or wrong.
So you've spoken about the SARS Section 12J. How significant is it? What impact has it had on the VC market in South Africa so far?
You know, there's about 2.5 billion rand already invested in the 12J VCCs. There's over 100 of them. The impact itself is starting to be felt. There are definitely VCCs actively investing in SMEs. It becomes a little bit easier in terms of access to capital for entrepreneurs as well as for funders like ourselves. You know, we always have to remind entrepreneurs if they think they pitch their hearts out to investors, you know, try asking investors for 50 million or 100 million rand at the time that you want to invest in very risky early stage ventures. You know, the institutional investors look at you and say you must be joking. And the angel investors are keen. I mean, we did build the VC industry on so-called super angels, like the Mark Shuttleworth, Sasa Plattners, Johan Rupert, Patrice Motsepe, Michael Jordan. A lot of these individuals are behind a lot of the successful VCs or so-called VCs. So the impact is significant from gathering capital and getting capital into the space. There is a lag effect, though, in terms of measuring things like job creation and so forth. So SAFCA, the South African Venture Capital Association, is at the moment launching a 12J impact study this year, so which will probably be out in later this year, to be able to really actively measure the impact that 12J has had. But it is starting to be felt, and it will be significant. I mean, there's 2.5 billion rand for earlier stage ventures, including junior mining, including some small hotel establishment, including just straight on SMEs that there wouldn't have been before so far. And it still continues until 2021, and we'll see what happens after that.
All right. Is there more government could be doing to encourage investment in the sector?
Absolutely. There's more everyone can do. Yeah. I think from a government perspective, people, you know, need to realize that there is a market failure in this space, meaning, you know, we've got a very well-established private equity sector, very well-established stock exchange. Yeah. You know, when it comes to early stage funding, specifically with South Africa's history, entrepreneurs just do not have access to security. So they can't go to traditional lenders like a bank to say, look, here's my affordability that I'm proving with my business plan. This is how I'm going to pay this back. And here's my security to be able to get the risk return into a level where I can actually afford the loan or whatever. You know, there are really some interesting companies, good companies like Business Partners, and some of the banks are coming out with innovative products. But at the end of the day, That's where sort of it all falls flat. So government can step in. I mean, I think my opinion is that they shouldn't be managing these funds themselves. They could make funds available. Many other governments, Israel and the UK, US, have had government-funded programs that specifically intervened, put capital behind privately owned venture capital managers, and then to take first loss, or there's different models, you know. I don't think we can go through all of them today, but that one can say to make it more palatable and easier for the private fund managers in this particular space to get additional risk capital behind entrepreneurs.
Are there sufficient ideas out there, are there sufficient startup businesses out there for the capital that's chasing them in South Africa?
Absolutely. There are quantity is not a problem. If one now has to overlay quality over the quantity, that's where it starts. That's where a lot of entrepreneurs don't make the cut. So, but the one thing, you know, we don't particularly lie awake at night on is where's the next investment going to come from. You still have to really educate the entrepreneurs around the valuation metrics and so forth. I mean, you want entrepreneurs to be quite aggressive about the year 3, 4, 5 projections, but sometimes, you know, we do know what it takes to build a company all the way for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years because we've done it with a number of these investments, pattern recognition and so forth. And you don't want to take the wind out of the sails, but at the same time, you have to acknowledge that the probability of that hockey stick curve might not be as hockey stick like as the entrepreneurs and everyone might believe, you know, which obviously gets priced in. So definitely enough ideas out there. We get surprised every week with something that is unique and protectable and so forth. But you know, at the end of the day, we are not necessarily looking for the next unicorn. We'd love to invest behind the next unicorn, but we see enough sustainable high growth businesses that kind of double their revenue year on year, that become sustainable, become profitable, and take maybe a little bit longer than one would do if you just throw a whole lot of investment money behind it. So it's a little bit of a different nuance to the type of entrepreneurs that South Africa produce. And I believe, you know, they are more sustainable. They build sustainable businesses just because there isn't, you know, layers and layers of capital that they can throw behind a business plan to make it eventually, hopefully, survive, you know. So it is more credible, those that get there in the end. But as always, the 80-20 rule, 80% of businesses are just not as good as the top quartile. Mm-hmm. And from that perspective, entrepreneurs also need to take a good hard look at themselves and figure out, am I actually the best in my game, or should I maybe go look for a job?
Well, related to that, Kurt, it's often said that VCs have to invest in 10, maybe more startups, and be lucky if one of those is a major success, that the other 9 muddle along or worse, go out of business. Is that the case in South Africa? Can VCs here afford that sort of rate of failure in the hope there's one big success?
No, they cannot. They'll be chased out of the company with their tails between their legs as absolute failed investment professionals. So I think the risk appetite here, you know, needs a little bit of work in terms of just how people view failure. I'm definitely not one for celebrating failure. I'm one for acknowledging it and learn your lessons and so forth. We've done an analysis of our portfolio, and about 65%. So our IRR, our internal rate of return, annualized return that we target for our investors are 40%.
Sure.
IRR. So that is obviously giving the taking the tax breaks and all of that into consideration. But if you don't, it's about between 30 and 40% in this particular game. So we've got, if we look at our total portfolio, which is not just Shuttleworth, other type of transactions that we've done, we are about 65% success rate around businesses that tick that box. About 10% are failures where we lose money, and about 25% are deals that are bumbling along, not necessarily dying a fast death, but are not particularly going to kind of give us any significant exit or so forth. So we have about a two-thirds, moderate success rate. You know, it's not, I'm not saying two-thirds of our companies are going to exit to NASDAQ-listed companies, but, you know, we've had some management buyouts which have been very successful, those type of things. So there's different exit methods, but and different ways you can even hold on to the companies and get your returns via dividends. But, yeah, I would say that's quite high, and I don't think we can necessarily expect that as the overall trend in VC. But it's definitely not the whole situation of 1 in 10 succeed, because that model, you really need to throw a lot of networks and hungry capital and stuff behind it, and it is a little bit more the models of, you know, the significant accelerators and some of the earlier stage VCs in South Africa. The VCs get a lot of criticism for entrepreneurs because we always, most of us ask for proven traction, you know, and they're like, well, how can I get traction if I don't have money to fund my idea? And we basically just say, look, I mean, it's just common sense. There are 100 business plans on my desk. 10 of them are entrepreneurs who had an idea, then did something about it. Friends, family, fools invested behind the idea. They managed to convince the client to pay them up front, and they hustled and got to this point now where we can see that they can execute. You know, the other 90 business plans might get there, but, you know, it is a little bit of a hit and miss, and Knife Capital certainly doesn't have the risk appetite to pick one of those. We'd rather pick an entrepreneur which have actually proven that that they can actually execute. So there is a little bit of a, yeah, I think it'll be good to have more early stage seed funds, angel investors to take some of the slack. Maybe government can get involved there, because I think most of the traditional VCs are a little bit, let's call it later stage, you know. So, I mean, and for Knife Capital, for instance, our absolute mandate criteria is businesses have to be post-revenue. So we have never, and well, touch wood, will never, unless it's in our private angel investment capacity, invest in just, I woke up with an idea this morning, you know?
Yeah. Kit, before I let you go, tell me a bit about the day-to-day role of a venture capitalist like yourself. Does it involve a lot of hand-holding?
It's a lot less glamorous than one might think. You know, we don't sit here and play Dragon's Den all day. We basically take on the problems of our whole portfolio of companies, never mind our own company, in terms of sustainability, cash flow, strategy, HR issues, so forth. But yeah, the day-to-day work, I mean, it's very exciting, but you have to be a little bit or a lot entrepreneurship activist, you know. So you can't just, this is not a normal job. It's a long game. You have to play some really good chess and sometimes a bit of poker when it comes to negotiations. But what we do is just kind of build our business around the three pillars of knowledge, networks, and funding. And what I mean by knowledge is we have to be good at what we do, which is taking a South African scale-up company international, really understanding the intellectual property things around it, doing proper due diligence, not as a fault-finding mission, but as a gap analysis mission, so that we can kind of help the companies fill that gaps. That then is the knowledge that we bring to the table, the mentorship element and so forth. And we need to make sure that the entrepreneurs are good at their craft. They have to be top of the game. They need to be good at the knowledge of the machine learning thing that they've done, like that we just invested in the company Data Profit, or Quicket is a ticketing company. They need to be very good at their game of issuing tickets, of understanding events, having some blue chip events, the long tail, and going into Africa. SkillUp is a company that's involved in mentorship / tutoring for businesses, and bringing the tutors and the learners together, and they need to understand that game, you know. So we need to kind of that element through our networks. We always say a high growth company in South Africa, when they have an issue, we need to be able to solve it within 3 phone calls. Not that so our network needs to be big enough that we know a guy that knows a girl that can actually introduce them to someone that can help them with this particular issue, you know. So also you get good deal quality deal flow through your networks, because that's already filtered. So we spend a lot of time, you know, networking not for the sake of networking, but building our credibility and making sure that the right people know what we're up about. And then funding. Yeah, at the end of the day, you need to constantly be raising funding, deploying capital, making sure that investors are kept up to date, that they are, you know, that we have proper governance, and we've got financial services board licenses and all those kind of things. So it's those 3 things that we basically do in various forms. But yeah, when we walk into this door, no day is the same. I never, well, I can check their schedules, but it's a bit of a hit and miss of which of my team would be in the office. You know, we meet exciting entrepreneurs. We sometimes, you know, have to obviously reject them quickly, try and not give them a slow maybe. So that's the job of a venture capitalist in South Africa, but it isn't as glamorous as people may think. But so that's why we celebrate hard when we do get an exit like this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Kit, this has been a great discussion. Congratulations on the Audit Talk exit. Kit Vincel is investment partner at Knife Capital. Thanks so much for talking to us on Tech Central today.
Thanks, Duncan. Yeah, it's been a pleasure.